Hey everybody, I'm Chris. I'm an addict alcoholic, and my sobriety date is 10/5/1998, and as my buddy says, nobody's more surprised about that than me. I always like to start off by saying that I'm kind of a gearhead. Like, I'm one of those people who, like, when I was 5 or 6 years old, I started taking things apart, trying to figure out how they worked, and by the time I was 8 or 9, I could mostly get them back together. And, you know, when I move into a new house, by the first day, I know what every light switch does because it freaks me out not to know what one does. You know, I'm that guy. I like to try to understand things. That was super helpful to me in most of my life. I focused it in the wrong direction when I got in the program because I wanted to try and understand this God business. I don't believe in God. I had a lot of animosity towards religion. We'll get into that as we go. After a while, the thought occurred to me that I don't need to understand what the nature of this power is. Like, a lamp doesn't need to have a loving relationship with the electric company. It just needs to know where the fucking socket is so it can plug itself in and perform a function. And that's me. It's like, I don't know what the power is. I don't care what it is. I just need to know where it is and how to get it, because if that's what's going to solve my problems, then that's what I need to know how to do it. So, a little bit about my backstory. I'm actually from Austin. There's like 10 of us that are actually born here. I'm one of them. Jennifer. And I come from a really good family. There's no real addiction in my family until this generation. In fact, like, my family, we're a bit of an outlier. Like, I had 7 aunts and uncles. None of them were ever divorced. My parents never got divorced. I had 1 cousin that got divorced, and he remarried the same woman 2 years later, and they've been married for 37 years. Like, I come from a very stable family. Nobody in my family drinks, hardly. And not even casually. It just wasn't a thing. I will say, on my mom's side of the family, there is some history of suicide, and I believe, having known my mom's sister, who tried that a couple of times, that the malady runs deep on my mom's side of the family. But if you live in a culture with the kind of malady that I had and no way to treat it because there is no drugs and alcohol, eventually suicide becomes the only way out. And I get that. So even though there was no addiction, I believe there is a history of spiritual malady, especially on my mom's side of the family. I was a happy kid. I come from a good house. I got 2 little brothers and a little sister, and everything was awesome, and I was a happy little kid until the first day of first grade. And then I went to grade school, and there was 28 other kids in that grade school, and I didn't know any of those kids, and they made me super uncomfortable. And so I began to eat. Food was my first drug of choice. You know, the story in my house was I was an active boy, and I started putting on weight when I had to sit down all day at school. That's an awesome story. It's horseshit. You know, there was no drugs or alcohol in my house, but there was Little Debbie's, and I'd eat the shit out of some Little Debbie's, you know, and like a lot of addicts, I always felt different than everybody around me. But the simple truth is, I was different than everybody around me. You know, when I was 7 years old, in 1968, I saw the Rolling Stones on Ed Sullivan one Sunday evening, and knew in that moment I was going to play a guitar in a rock band. That's what I want to do with my life. Like, and from that point forward, all I cared about was music. I literally knew what I wanted to be when I grew up, when I was 7. I started buying albums at the hippie garage sales in my neighborhood. I grew up right by the UT campus. There was lots of hippies selling, you know, albums. I didn't even care what it was. I just buy it. I don't care. The cover looks interesting. Started going to concerts when I was 12 years old, when I went to middle school. And I know now that middle school is a holding pen for hormonally unstable lunatics. And even the president of the student council and the captain of the football team feel weird and left out if it's the wrong day. But I was weird and left out because everybody in my high school was kids from far north Austin that I didn't go to grade school with. And I had hair down to here when I was 12 years old, and I was, you know, 5'11" and 200 pounds, and I was walking around with a tape deck listening to Black Sabbath in 1973, and, like, I was different. And I started going to concerts by myself because I didn't know anybody that wanted to go, and my parents would just drive me down to Palmer Auditorium and let me get out, and I'd go see whoever. And surprisingly, at a lot of those concerts, people were smoking a lot of marijuana. And in the beginning, it freaked me out a little bit. They're passing joints back and forth, and I'm going, oh, this is weird, this is weird. But by the third or fourth concert I went to, they seemed like nice people, and it's coming by anyway, so I'll try a little bit. And I liked it quite a bit. Made the concert better. And in 1974, it was way easier to get than alcohol. And so I started smoking a ton of weed in middle school. Went really good with the food, you know. I'd smoke a joint, getting off the bus with my buddy, and then go to the grocery store and buy an entire Boston cream pie, and I was all set, you know. So I'm smoking a lot of weed and eating, and high school rolls along, and I start drinking because the drinking age is 18, and I'm, you know, 6 feet tall and 220 pounds, and I've got the beginnings of a beard at 16 years old. It was not hard to get alcohol. But my story of addiction is a little different than some people's. Like, I know people very close to me, even some like right here in this group, that were like blackout drinking as in grade school. That's not my story. You know, my story was I drank and I used for quite a long time and had a really good time doing it. It was fucking A fun. And then I drank and I used for quite a few years and it was still fun, but there was starting to be a lot of consequences. And then I drank and used for a while, and it was kind of crappy. And then I drank and I used for a few years, and it totally sucked, and I wished I were dead all day every day. And then I got sober. But in high school, it was still working. I discovered skateboarding in high school. I found my people, you know, the Island of Misfit Toys. There was like 20 skateboarders in all of Austin in the 70s, and I was one of them. And we were smoking pot and listening to AC/DC and going skating all the time, and it was great. I graduated from high school in 1979. I had hair down to here and a big giant fuck-off beard. And 3 months later, my hair was an inch long and bleached blonde, and I was in a punk band. Like, I had discovered the beginnings of the punk scene in Austin as a senior in high school. I was like, I don't know what the hell is going on here, but I'm going to come be a part of it. You know, these people are the right kind of weird for me. And I put my first band together with a bunch of my skate buddies. And we started playing, and we started getting good, and we started getting popular, and making records, and touring. And there were an awful lot of people in that music scene, and everybody was smoking a lot of weed and drinking a shitload of beer. And there were some people in that scene that were doing quite a bit of meth, and those people freaked me out a little bit. But by the time I was 21, I was drinking so much that I started passing out. Like, my friends liked me, but they couldn't get me back to the car, so they just rolled me on my stomach and leave me where I dropped. And so my solution to that was not to drink less. It was to buddy up to the guys who were doing meth, because by now we're friends and they seem like okay guys. And, you know, some of them were using needles, and that freaked me out, but I eventually got to know those people too. First band ends. Second band I was in, the other two main guys in my first band were 7 and 13 years older than me. Second band I was in, almost everybody in the band was my age. And at this point in time, almost all of the surviving members of that band are sober, whether they're sober in the program or they just finally knocked it off, either way. But we were drinking like crazy people and doing it. I was dealing meth by this point because, you know, like you do. And you know, we were just roaring drunk all the time. I mean, I've got a live recording of that band where the entire band is on acid and we don't sound any different than we did when we were just playing a regular show. So it was like, it was that kind of band. That band did pretty good too. We made a couple of records. We toured the country. And in 1996, the punk rock scene was getting kind of stale. I had gotten pretty good on the guitar by then. And I was out in Los Angeles on tour and I ran into a couple of my buddies from an old punk band. And they had started a rock band. And I was going, well, that sounds interesting. And the whole rest of the band came back to Texas, and I stayed for a few extra days with a girl that I knew out there, and I went and saw their first show in the basement of this apartment complex where a bunch of my buddies lived. And they played first, and a band called Faster Pussycat played second, and Guns N' Roses played third in front of 40 people in the basement of an apartment complex, and I went, fuck yeah, I'm starting a rock band. And I came back to Texas, and I tried to convince my buddies to come out with me, and they said no. And so I packed up everything I owned in my that would fit into my little Honda Accord, and I drove my ass out to Los Angeles with $65 in my pocket to start a band. You know, now I got to tell you that moving to Los Angeles in 1986 was a lot like returning to middle school. One of these things is not like the others. You know, everybody in L.A. in the rock scene was, you know, dressing like girls and sounding like Poison, and I show up looking like me. And the spandex don't come in my size, and I'm not wearing them anyway. And I couldn't even find anybody that wanted to play with me. You know, nobody wants to be in a band with a fat guy from Texas. He's doing this wholly other thing. But I found some guys, mostly guys from punk bands. We put a rock band together, and 9 months later, I had a major label record deal. I also met this cute goth girl who lived two blocks from my house who was dealing the best crystal meth I had ever seen in my life. And it was love at first 7 day run. You know, we stayed up for a week the day we met. Very quickly, I was at her house all the time. She warned me in the beginning, you don't want to get involved with me. She was right, but I didn't believe her. I'm doing tons of meth. I've got all this pressure because it's my band and I'm writing the songs and I'm sort of doing all the, I'm sort of in charge of everything and I'm doing shitloads of meth. I'm dealing meth with her. Get the first record made. The video comes out. It's on MTV. The first single is starting to get a lot of radio play on the rock stations. I'm getting ready to leave on tour in 2 days on our first real tour. And the DEA comes through the front door of the cook who I'm a partner with. They come through the front door of his house with a battering ram. And happily, I didn't get tangled up in that at all. And I sat down with my girlfriend and we had this conversation. And I think we were talking about not doing drugs anymore. We were definitely talking about not dealing drugs anymore. And, you know, my thinking was like, dudes like me don't get opportunities like this. And I don't want to fuck it up because of this stupid drug dealing thing. And then I climbed in a tour bus and left on tour. And within 3 days, I was drinking the better part of a fifth of vodka every day and doing as much cocaine as I could talk the crew out of because they were the only ones on salary at that point. And within 2 weeks, she was strung out on heroin because both of us were way past stopping. And back then in the music industry, as long as you were making money, nobody said anything about your drug use. And everybody in L.A. was completely strung out. And when I came back from tour, I was paying for a lot of the heroin, so I went, fuck it, I guess I'm going to use it if I'm buying it. And, you know, I've been awake for 8 years. I could use a nap. And so I started using heroin. And it was like there's a guy on this meeting I think that I played in a band with later. And we were in New York one time and went uptown to this person's house after the show and snorted a bunch of China White. And there were two guys from the other band with us. And all they ever did was cocaine. And they snorted some big lines and sat down. 30 minutes later, one of them said, dude, this is the fucking weirdest coke ever. And I was like, you know, like, I had been doing meth for a really long time. The thing about meth is it removes doubt. Like, when you're on meth, whatever you're doing is exactly what you're supposed to be doing, even if you're in a closet taking apart a fucking VCR at 4 a.m. It's what I'm supposed to be doing. Right up until you roll past a line on it, and all there is doubt. And then I did heroin. And unlike alcohol, unlike weed, unlike meth, heroin fixed the problem of me. For a few hours every day, I felt whole. And that was terrifying. Because I'm in the rock and roll world. I know what happens. I know how this goes. And it's funny because, like I said, I had a lot of animosity about religion and all kinds of stuff when I first got to the program. But my motto at this stage of the game was, I don't pray for parking spaces. And what that means is I take care of the little stuff that I can take care of and big stuff happens for me before I even know I need it. And that was the story of my life. Every band I was in got offered labels approached us and said, hi, can we make a record for you? And like, it was just all this great stuff kept happening. And I knew as soon as I started doing heroin every day, that deal with the universe was over. And I was not wrong. Made another record, didn't sell as well. And you listen back to it now and it's like a fucking dark, it's not a party rock and roll record, that's for sure. you know, Kiss wanted to rock and roll all night and party every day. And this whole record was, I'm homeless, my friend just died, I'm dying, somebody else is dying. Songs like, you know, Killing Time and Back on the Streets. And just, yeah, it was a dark record. We were trying to make our third record when Nevermind came out by Nirvana, and we were on the same label as them. And as soon as that video hit MTV, we all looked at each other and went, well, it's over, isn't it? And we, yeah, because we were all from punk bands. We could smell it. And I got a job working for a fashion accessories guy, you know, manufacturing high-end fashion accessories, running his production facility, and I was making enough money to stay strung out. And that scared me to death. After about 6 months, I realized that I could just circle the drain forever in that job. And I didn't think I could get sober in L.A. So I decided to get out of L.A. and come to Austin, come to my dad's house. You know, there won't be heroin in Texas. So I sold my motorcycle and a bunch of other shit and bought a crappy van and put whatever would fit into it and headed out for Texas. The day before I left, my girlfriend, who hadn't spoken to me in 3 weeks because I refused to pay for any more of her dope, asked if she could come too. So I said, yeah. And so I loaded her and two fucking cats into this van with all this crap that I don't even know why we bothered to bring it, and headed out across country. And it took us nearly 5 days to get to Austin because heroin isn't a good cross-country driving drug. And we kept having to say, where did the cat go? You know, and we finally got here, and we landed at my dad's house, and we bought a shitload of pills so that we could detox when we got here, and we went through a week of that. And then we didn't really do anything for 2 or 3 weeks. We tried to find jobs, tried to figure out what we were going to do next. And about 3 weeks after we got here, my girlfriend had a psychotic episode. We had to call EMS, and she ended up in the hospital. And the paramedics kept asking us what she was on. And the truth is, she was on nothing. She was on untreated spiritual malady, and it caused a psychotic break. And they had to sedate her for a couple of days to bring her back. And as soon as she got out of the hospital, we brushed off our Spanish, we headed for Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, and that was that. And, you know, once moving didn't help anything, for me, it was like all bets are off. Like, I'm too chicken to kill myself, but I spent all day every day wishing I were dead and terrified of dying, which is a really awesome place to live. And, you know, I'm convinced, I say this all the time, if living and dying were my only options, eventually at some point in the 90s, I would have killed myself. But heroin allowed me not to exist for some portion of every day, and that was just enough to keep going. And I got involved in a bunch of stuff that a nice boy from a good family doesn't get involved in. You know, my 21-year-old roommate killed himself in my house, OD'd on purpose because he thought he was going to jail because he got busted with a small amount of cocaine. And I had to deal with the fallout of that. And, you know, I had to watch somebody I was close to disappear into homelessness and prostitution. And I'm trying to be a good guy, and I'm trying to have jobs, and I'm growing weed in the dead guy's room because nobody will rent it. And, you know, the cops come busting into my house and find all the weed because my idiot roommate climbed in the window. But somehow or another, I didn't get arrested for it. And, there goes all my income, and my habit is high, and I'm having to carry a gun to get the money I need, and it's just not good. You know, all day, every day, my first thought every morning was, fuck, not again. Like, I thought, yesterday I got this solved somehow, and today it's back. And I don't know what I'm going to have to do to come up with the money I need to be okay in my skin for today. I spent every day the last 2 years I was using trying to stop, trying to figure out a way to stop. I can't tell you how many times I kicked. I can't tell you how many times I bought a shitload of, at the time it wasn't even Suboxone, it was Buprenix, or a bunch of Tylenol 3s and tried to detox myself, or signed up on methadone and got back on, like, over and over and over, and nothing ever worked. I even went to 4 or 5 meetings, and the hand of AA was so busy trying to sleep with each other and go to dinner after the meeting that nobody ever reached out and tried to help me at all. Not once. And the reason I didn't go to Austin Recovery was because I didn't know it was there. And I kept getting more and more hopeless. And during the last 4 months I was using, I overdosed and died and was brought back to life by the paramedics or my roommate 4 times. you know, like about, I guess, nearly 10 years ago now, I had to do a stress test, like run on the fucking treadmill with all the wires on you and shit for, I don't even know why, something. I have health insurance, whatever. And after the stress test, they're looking at my EEG printout and they're going, when did you have your heart attack, Mr. Gates? And I went, I never had a heart attack. And then I stopped and went, would that Pulp Fiction thing, would that be a heart attack? And they went, yeah. And I said, oh, I did that twice in 98. Apparently I've had a couple of heart attacks. Didn't know, wasn't there. The thing that changed everything for me, and humans are creatures of pattern recognition. It's real easy to look back and find a pattern, but that's what it is anyway. I'm going to talk about the gifts I received that led me to the beginning of a path of sobriety. The first gift was one day I was sitting at my desk putting some target sights on a pistol for my dad. The only way we could talk to each other was to take him shooting. He was old, he wasn't in very good health, and I'd pick him up once in a while and drive him out to the range and we'd shoot some pistols together. And his arthritis was bad, and I was putting some sights on this pistol for him, and my dealer showed up at my house. And I found myself sitting at my desk with a syringe in one hand and a gun in the other one, trying to decide which one to use. And it wasn't that thing, I don't know if you did it, I did it a lot, that thing where I'm sitting alone and going, why doesn't somebody see what I just need? Why doesn't somebody? Like, wasn't that. It was just cool and calm, which one am I going to use, today or forever? And I swear to God, for 1 minute, I was all the way across the room looking at my own back going, how in the fuck did those become my only choices? I agree they're my only choices, but what happened? I used to have this fucking life. I mean, Christ's sake, I was on MTV for 35 seconds, and now my only choices are today or forever? What the fuck? There has to be a way to function in this world without all this dope, and I have no idea what it is. And then I got hot. Because I wasn't convinced. Nobody could offer me any solid evidence that dying made it better. That sucks. What if killing yourself doesn't fix it? Fuck! I mean, there's a sect of Hindus that believes that if you die without dealing with the problems of the body, you go into an incarnation with no body, and that's purgatory forever. And then the second gift I received was later that same day. I'm channel surfing, and I run across on the news magazine 2020, they're doing a feature about this jazz saxophone player. And since I'm a little kid, if there's anything on TV about music, I'm watching it. And it's hard to imagine now if you're not over 40 or whatever, but like growing up in the 60s and 70s and 80s, you had the record cover and like Circus magazine, and maybe if the band came to town, you got to see them, but that was it. No information, no nothing. So I don't care if it's a fucking Sonny and Cher show, I'm watching. It's music, it's all I got. So jazz saxophone player, fine, whatever. This guy named Buddy Arnold. And they're talking about how he played with all the greats in the 60s and the 70s. And they go, and he was a heroin addict for 30 years. And I'm going like, well, that's a weird thing to include. But it turns out the story had nothing to do with his music career. See, Buddy Arnold was 10 years sober, and he had just started an organization called the Musicians Assistance Program that was funded by the Grammys. And all it was for was paying for professional musicians to go to rehab. And I went, holy shit, that's my ticket. That's it, right there, that's it. And I wrote down the name of the, you know, I was high, I had to write down MAP because I would have forgotten. And I ran in the other room and I jumped on my computer and I did a quick search, and 6 minutes later the website loaded because it was 1998 and it was fucking AOL dial-up, and there was one photo on the page so it wouldn't load. But I managed to get their information and I called them the next day. And I would love to say that I was willing and they scooped me up, but I had just enrolled at ACC because what I really needed is some job training. And I had a 28-day gap before school started, and they wanted me to go to 30 days of rehab. And I went like, can I leave 2 days early so I don't miss the first day of school? And they said, call us back when you're serious. I went, okay. So I went to school for a week and called them back and said, I think I'm serious. And they gave me the number of a treatment center out in the Hill Country. And I called that treatment center up, and they found out I was on methadone. And they said, wow, we can't take you on methadone. You should just stop taking that methadone, and we'll see you 6 weeks from today. And what they were telling me without spelling it out was that they couldn't manage the methadone detox. I was going to be so freaking sick the whole time I was there that I wouldn't get anything out of a 30-day rehab. But if I went back to heroin full-time, that would mask the worst of it, and they could deal with the heroin detox when I got there. So that's what I did. That was also a gift. That was the third gift I got. Because I had been working with a net for the last 6 or 8 months. You know, if I'm trying not to get high today, I can still do my methadone. That doesn't count, right? Except that I always end up buying crack because I'm nodding out from all the methadone. But I had to work without a net. And if today's the day the dude sleeps, I'm screwed. And it was ugly. And I wanted to be done. I wanted to be stopped every day for 6 weeks, and I still had to keep going out there and finding a way to get $100, $150 a day just to be well. And it was ugly, and it showed me just how ugly my life really was. And then about a week before I went, my on-again, off-again girlfriend, we kept breaking up because we were dying together, but then I kept running into her in the same parking lot, waiting for the same dude. And she grabbed me and said, "You need to think about why you're going to treatment. Because if you go for the wrong reason and it doesn't work, I'm afraid you're going to die for good next time." And I sat down after she left and went, "Why am I going? I mean, am I going because my life is a shit show and I got more warrants than I can even count, and the police in South Austin are driving around with my photo in their car, and every time I leave the house I commit a felony, and my house caught fire, and the reason I didn't die in the fire was because a box of ammo exploded and woke my ass up, and I put the fire out and didn't tell the landlord? Like, is that why I'm going?" And then I realized none of that had anything to do with the reason I was going. The reason I was going was because I had to believe that there was a way to live without this substance, just to go to the grocery store and have a job without having to do heroin to do it. And that I didn't know what that way was, but that maybe the people at this place did. And that was the reason I was going. And that's a true gift because having worked in the business for a while, I watch a lot of people who say they want to be sober, but as soon as they get some manageability back in their life, they're fucking gone. And so that was a gift that I was able to answer that question before I ever even got to treatment. My first real memories of treatment, because the detox wasn't pretty, was staggering up the hill into my first on-campus AA meeting, and I'm a little fuzzed up on detox meds, and people start talking, and some guy starts talking about God, and my head clears up for half a second. I go, "Oh, fuck!" And that's the last thing I remember. You know, 5 hours later, I'm laying down there shitting and pissing myself and throwing up and going, "I'm at church camp. What's happening?" You know, and I had no idea the 12 steps were going to be a part of the treatment center, which is great because it didn't give me a chance to work up an argument. Rehab was like middle school. You know, this is a $30,000 rehab. Everybody there had nice skin and all their teeth. I didn't have any of that stuff. I was on a charity bed. But there was a dude that worked there. He was an old biker guy. And he helped me sit down and he talked to me about the first step. And he helped me examine my experience. And he helped me understand why even drinking was going to be impossible for a guy like me. You know, I hadn't had a drink in 2 years because I read a story that said alcohol washed heroin out of your bloodstream faster, so I stopped drinking. But he helped me look at my own story and see what happens when you drink. Because all those the last 2 years you were trying to quit all the time, but you kept drinking. What happened? You kept ending up back on heroin every time. And he helped me understand that unmanageability is not that chaos of my life and addiction. The unmanageability is tied to the mental obsession. Like, once I stop, the things that my brain does to me make me pick up and start again. And that I can't, once I put it in me, I can't always control how much I do, and it always escalates over time, and I cannot stop and stay stopped comfortably on my own. And he really helped me wrap my head around the real nature of step one. I mean, I hear a lot of people say, "I did step one while I was still out there." It's like, I did a lot of research on step one, but I had no fucking idea. And you hear all kinds of dumb horseshit about powerlessness and unmanageability in the rooms. Like, "Oh, I'm powerless over everything," which sounds awesome and spiritual, and it's total horseshit. You know, it's just a way to sound spiritual and absolve yourself from having to do anything. You know, "I'm just turning it over to God. Turn it over to God. Show me that in the literature." You know, there's fucking step work to do most of the time. You know, powerless over people, places, and things. Yeah, that's true, but it's irrelevant because so is everybody else, whether they're an addict or not. So it's not really an issue. But I can't always control how much I drink and use. And people who aren't addicts can always. I needed to understand that. And I really, he really helped me internalize step one. Step two and three was 2 weeks of arguing about whether God exists with other people in a mental facility. Because I kept hearing him read in meetings that God either is or he isn't. And I thought we needed to decide, the world needs to know. Steps two and three terrified me. You know, I always say 70% of most of my life, 70% of the shit I'm doing, nobody has any interest in doing but me. And that's fine with me. But the other 30% of my time was spent being unable to do things that people who weren't smarter than me and didn't have more resources than me seemed to be able to do it with ease. And then I got to rehab and they start saying, God's the answer. And I'm going, great, this is just another one of those things I don't get to do because I don't believe and I'm not gonna. And they're going, well, fake it till you make it. And I was going, I don't think that works here. I don't think that's how this works. But I have to believe that there's something in here. My first pass through the second and third step literally was 2 weeks of arguing about whether God existed, but also asking everybody who was in the rehab with me, who was there for their second or 10th or in one case 25th rehab in 10 years. And it turned out almost all of them had never done a fourth step. So whatever that was, fuck that. I needed to do that because nobody's paying for me to come back. And so I jumped into my fourth step, and apparently 2 weeks of arguing and going, fuck it, and doing a fourth step is enough because I stayed sober. You know, my understanding of two and three is a little more nuanced now. You know, I believe the sanity I'm being restored to doesn't imply that I'm insane. Big Book uses the word insanity 47 times in the first 164 pages, and every time it's the insanity of the first drink. So what the second step is really asking me is, am I willing to believe that a connection to some sort of higher power can remove the mental obsession from me? That's the insanity that I need to be restored from, because the fact that my body reacts differently when I put drugs and alcohol in would not matter if I didn't put drugs and alcohol in. But I can't not put it in because of what my fucking head does. You know, I always say, like, I'm allergic to wheat, but I never sat in a dark room crying and eating the brownies anyway. But I've totally been that guy with heroin over and over and over again. You know, am I willing to believe that there's a spiritual solution to the problem of being Chris so that I don't need drugs and alcohol anymore? Not do I believe, but am I willing to believe? And how I came to believe that was, once again, Ray, the guy at the treatment center. You know, he told me a story. He asked me if I thought we were the same, and I said, yeah. Biggest difference in me and Ray is he kept going to jail for shit that I didn't quite get convicted of. And then he asked me, do you think I'm just better at staying sober than you? Because he was nearly 10 years sober at the time. And I told him, no, I think something else is happening because you seem happy. And I can't imagine just trying to stay sober on your own for 10 years would lead to anything but misery. And he said, right. Are you willing to believe me when I tell you that I worked these steps and I haven't fought that fight in a decade? I did this seemingly unrelated stuff. And it solved the problem so that the obsession's just gone. And in that moment, I came to believe Ray. I had that identification with him, you know. Bill talking to Abby, Dr. Bob talking to Bill, me talking to Ray. Once I believed we were the same, I began to have hope that if I did what he did, maybe I could get what he was getting. And so that began to move me into the process. You know, early sobriety was crazy. The first 6 months, I could barely make whole sentences. Like, I stammered a lot, and I'm not very social anyway. So, like, I'd go to a meeting at Bolden or someplace, and then after the meeting, I'd go stand outside for 5 minutes and have to go home and sit in the dark for an hour to calm down. I was so overstimulated, you know. But by the time I got to about 6 months sober, I could make whole sentences, and at that point in history, whole sentences was all it took to sleep with the girls at Bolden, so that's what I started doing. You know, everybody says don't get in a relationship in the first year, but nobody's 100% sure how that worked because almost nobody does it. You know, after about a month and a half of that, I had to knock it off because I couldn't go there anymore. I don't know if it's still this way or not. I don't go to that clubhouse anymore. But back in the 90s or in the early 2000s, there was a thing called the Bolden breakup, which is like you sleep with a bunch of inappropriate people and then you break up with them and then they get the 8 p.m. and you get the 5:30 and they get Flipnotics and you get Halcyon. Like, you split up the coffee shops and the meetings and everybody's doing it and it's the Bolden breakup. And I also remember being about 120 days sober, and I'm in the amends process. And I remember sitting down with my sponsor and going, dude, I think the promises are happening. Like, I'm starting to feel, like, comfortable in my skin, and I think it's happening. I think I found what the program is offering. And he looked at me and went, No, you haven't. I'm sorry, no, you haven't. And I don't know why I didn't get mad at him, but instead I went, what are you talking about? And he said, dude, you're better than you've been in a decade, easy. And you're still so freaking far from good, it scares me every time I fucking see you. There's a guy from that original home group who's the guy who got me the job at Austin Recovery. And every time I'm in a group with him, he tells people that for the first 6 months I was coming to the men's meeting where I sobered up, they were all certain at some point I was going to snap and kill at least one or two of them. I thought I was doing fucking great. You know, like, apparently I was a little intense even then. I asked him, you mean it gets better than this? And he's going, oh, so much better. Please don't stop what you're doing because it's good. Because it's gotten better than it was. Please don't stop. You know, please don't set the line between good and bad at sober. Because then you'll think you're good right up until you're not sober. You know, let's try and set the bar higher. And for me, the bar now is at happy, joyous, and free. If I'm not happy, joyous, and free, there's spiritual work to do because I'd like to be happy, joyous, and free. And that way staying sober stays in the rearview mirror because it takes a lot more spiritual connection to be happy, joyous, and free than it does to just to battle the obsession. So I keep working the steps. I'm still struggling with the God part. I don't say the Lord's Prayer at the end of meetings. You know, I'll hold your hand, but I'm not going to pray with you. I used to look around the meeting to see who wasn't praying like me, you know, finding the cool people. And then a little over a year sober, I went to a reunion at the treatment center where I sobered up, and there were hundreds of people there, and they had an amazing speaker speaking in the morning. It was like listening to one of the Sopranos tell his story. I have a recording of it if you want to let me know. It's fucking, like, it's insane. And then all these hundreds of people circled up in the lawn and were holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer. And I'm looking around this big-ass circle doing what I always do, trying to see who's not praying. But for this entire year, I've been doing a lot of step work. And I'm looking around this big-ass circle, and the thought occurs to me that if even half of these people were as miserable as I was when I came to this place and was standing on this piece of dirt, this is a fucking miracle. And the word had substance in that moment. You know, not I got my way, it's a miracle. Not they didn't arrest me, it's a miracle. Like, the charges got dropped, it's a miracle. But you know, hundreds of crackheads and meth addicts and junkies and alcoholics fully clothed and in their right minds driving all the fucking way out to Kerrville to do this on purpose. It's a miracle. It would have been like a plague of locusts if 500 of us had descended on Kerrville using, you know. And in that moment, the cumulative effect of all those small spiritual experiences woke me up. And I remember standing there going, son of a bitch. Like, it's working, not just me, looking after, son of a bitch. And like, I came home and I realized that I had been only doing the first 11 steps. It had all been about the acquisition of power for Chris, which now I understand is called spiritual hoarding. As much God as I can have for me. But then it was explained to me that until I start transmitting the power that I'm collecting, I don't ever have enough to really start becoming different. It's in the transmission that enough flows through me to have enough power to actually begin to affect change in my own life. And once I found out that my spiritual growth was contingent on people getting worked with, people started getting worked with. First I did what everybody in the fucking meetings does. I sat around and I raised my hand and tried to be attractive. But the 11th tradition doesn't have a single fucking thing to do with the 12th step. And if I'm sitting in a meeting and you're sitting in a meeting, my job is not to be it's promotion. You know, just standing over here and trying to look awesome to you is not helpful. I need to come try and draw you with a vision of what's possible, and that means being a little more proactive. And the first guy I saw, I saw this dude, 35-year-old redheaded Irish guy, come walking into the meeting. His insurance only paid for 4 days of detox, so he's still a little bit see-through and shaky. And I walked up to him at the end of the meeting when he raised his hand and said it was his first meeting. He said, hi, I'm Chris, I'm your sponsor. When he got a year, he said, I don't know, I just thought it was his turn. He freaked me out, whatever. So. But I don't wait around for people to ask me. And it was terrifying. You know, what am I supposed to tell them? It's like, my sponsor said, just call me. And I'll tell you what to tell them. And then after the first meeting, you can call me. And I'll tell them what to tell them next time. I'll remind you what we did. You don't need to know. You've never done this. Of course you don't know. The only way to be good at it is to be bad at it first. So show up and suck. You know? And I sponsored a shitload of people the first 3 or 4 years. And almost only like 2 of them ever got past the 4th step. But I got really clear on the first 4 steps. You know, I got really, really clear on explaining that shit. And it wasn't until after I had a year that I realized I didn't even know how to do the fourth step. You know, I had done two, but I didn't know how to do it because my first sponsor didn't know either. And it took my second sponsor, who was talking about living in 10, 11, and 12, to explain the mechanics of the process to me so it could become a practical tool. And learning to do 10 is where I got sober on October 5th of 1998, but my recovery starts about 14 or 15 months later when I got a new sponsor, and he showed me how to do the 10th step. You know, and it has become an integral piece of what I do. First couple of years, I felt like shit. I had a lot of health issues. That hasn't entirely gone away, but I kept doing the work. A year into my recovery, I realized that most of the old timers in my home group were fucking miserable all day, every day. So I had to go find a new home group where people weren't miserable. People with long-term sobriety were still having awesome lives. I also realized that at 2 years sober, 80% of the chaos in my life wasn't caused by me. It was allowed by me because of the people who I let get close to me. And I had to cut myself off from a bunch of my friends who had less time now than they did a year ago. And I started playing music again. You know, I thought my music career was over, but at 11 months sober, I found myself in L.A. playing a string of shows at the House of Blues and mixing a live record that came out. And for the next 5 or 6 years, I got to go to Europe two or three times a year. I got to go to Japan. I had this awesome time until it wasn't fun anymore and I stopped. I knew I wanted to be in a relationship, and I knew that I didn't know how to do that. I kept doing the same thing over and over again with different women. But I had a sponsor who explained that I was trying to find a partner to fix me, and that's not my partner's job. That sex and relationships only have two functions, to make babies and because they're pleasurable. But I'm trying to get all my third column needs fixed by some poor woman. You know, and I keep picking the broken one, thinking I can fix her up. You know, and I had to do several years worth of work and go through this long process to even remotely be capable of being in the kind of relationship I have now. And I still have to do work. But it's the beauty of it is it's a process. You know, if you really want the kind of relationship I have, I can tell you exactly what I did to get it. And I know it works because I've walked three other men through it and they're all in happy relationships too. My careers keep changing. You know, I don't have any... You know, I went back to school at a year and a half sober because I realized I had no marketable skills, and I became a web developer and a commercial artist. I did that for 6 or 7 years till the economy went tits up. And then one thing, the world kept changing and kept putting stuff in front of me that was scary, but I had to say yes. You know, I believe that every single person is born with a talent. Every one of you has something about you that comes easily to you that doesn't come easy to your friends. That's all I mean by talent. Maybe it's a big showy thing, like, and people go, ooh, and maybe it's something quiet and no one ever notices. But if you think about it for a minute, most of you have some inkling what that might even be. The kind of thing where you go, anybody can do this, and your friend goes, eh, not me. And I heard a thing that was attributed to the Dalai Lama saying that the 12-step approach to spirituality is the largest leap forward in spiritual thought in 200 years. And that often it's people in the process of recovery who are the only ones who ever reach a spiritual place to begin to ask the question, what is that thing about me that I'm uniquely suited to bring to the world? And how might I develop it for the maximum benefit of myself and those around me? You know, that's where I find myself today. I'm still being pushed all the time, but I think I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. For exactly what I'm supposed to be doing it for. And I'm not special. If you do what I do, you will get your version of this. You will find yourself in a place where you can begin to ask, what is that thing in me? Maybe it's a job, maybe it's just something you do, I don't know. But I can't wait to fucking see what that is. You know, it's like, let me wrap up with this. Like, I think our country has been sliding into spiritual malady since the end of World War II. And every successive generation has been afforded the opportunity to think about themselves a little bit more. And that self-centeredness has led to a spiritual disconnection at the cultural level. I think if you take what happened to me at the personal level and expand it to the cultural level, it's the only way I can make sense of Germany in 1930, where family men who loved their wives and children fell into lockstep behind a genocidal fuckhead. Regardless of your political affiliations now, I think the further out you get on the political spectrum, the more and more you see that fear and malady driving people looking for a desperate solution. And I read a thing by Eckhart Tolle where he said that at some point in the history of the earth, there were no flowering plants. It was all ferns. But then at some point, one or two species of plant began to flower, and it made no real difference. And over 100,000 years, a few more species began to flower. But then the earth hit a place where about 7 or 8% of the plants began to be flowering plants. And in a very short amount of time, evolutionarily, we went from 7% to 85% flowering plants. The tipping point isn't 80%, it's 7%. I think there are pockets of spiritual growth out in the world. I think the 12-step community is one of them, where if we can do the fucking work we need to do to be comfortable in our own skins and help people to do it when they show up, and begin to ask those questions about what can I do to the world, and start being happy, and start being happy right in front of everybody, that eventually people start going, what the fuck are you doing? Because I'm miserable. And whether they're an addict or not, maybe it can help change the whole world. But in the meantime, I get to be happy and have a big, cool life, and I get to help other people do it too. And I can't wait to see what that stuff is for you guys. Like at the end of a meeting, most of the meetings I go to don't say the Lord's Prayer, but if I'm in a meeting now that's ending with the Lord's Prayer, I still don't say it. But instead of saying the words, I'm looking at your faces and listening to the music. I'm the type of guy, since I was a little kid, if I find a song I like, you're going to hear it. Whether you want to or not, I'm going to make you fucking listen. And this is just the best song ever.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
Wow, blown away.
Thank you, Chris.
I like that part when you ended.
Yeah, that's the best part always. That's always the best part.
You've been through a lot, I'll tell you.
Yeah. That was awesome, man. Great job.